Rob is from the Underground Group. They meet at 4th and Lombard in Center City, Philadelphia, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday nights, 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock. Our speaker this evening is Rob B. Please.
Thanks, Rob.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Robert Bachrock, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Feet First Group for having me up here to speak. It's an honor, and I love doing this. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober since January 5th of 2005. My home group is the Underground, Old Pine Community Center, 4th and Lombard, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, 8 to 9. Tuesday's a big book study, Thursday night's a big book topic meeting, and Friday night's a one-hour speaker meeting similar to this format. Please come and see us. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous many, many, many years ago, you know, I saw on the wall where it said we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I thought, oh, I'm in the wrong place. But, you know, if you're the truth of the matter is, if you're anything like me, most of my life, the only time I ever felt sane is when I was drunk. You know, to the rest of the world, I looked drunk, but inside, I felt sane. I didn't look sane. I didn't act sane. But it's the only time I ever felt comfortable in my own skin. It's the only time I ever felt like I fit in anywhere. And so, apparently, I've spent my whole life searching for a power greater than myself that will restore me to sanity. I just didn't look in the right place. Not right away. And that's the story I'm going to tell you tonight is about my search for that power. And my search for that power started long, long before I ever picked up a drink because I grew up, I didn't feel sane. You know, I was restless, irritable, and discontented. I grew up in a, you know, I know it's not really fashionable in AA these days, but I grew up in an alcoholic household. Both of my parents are alcoholics. I don't know how much that has to do with me being an alcoholic. I suspect it had something to do with it, but, you know, if that's the truth, then it's one more thing I have to thank my parents for because turns out being an alcoholic is the best thing that ever happened to me. But, you know, I grew up feeling like I was never a part of anything. I felt apart from all the time. I didn't feel like I fit in at school. I didn't do well at school. I suffered from a couple of different learning disabilities. They didn't have fancy three-letter acronyms back then, but I just had a lot of trouble paying attention. I wasn't the best reader in the world. I just thought school was a complete waste of time, and I basically sat in the classroom for 12 years and daydreamed. But I didn't fit in with my peers. I didn't feel like I fit in with my family. I was uncomfortable in my own skin. And I felt that way all the time. And, you know, I didn't realize it then, of course. I've only come lately to realize that it's because I'm so self-centered that if I'm not the center of attention all the time, then I feel completely left out. You know, it's no wonder I love doing this, right? But this is how I feel when I'm growing up. And it's not anything that's apparent or obvious to me. It's more like, you know, on a subconscious level. But I feel that way right up until I take my first drink. And, you know, if you're an alcoholic like me, you know what I mean. You know, my life, I heard a guy put it this way about a couple months ago. He said, my life went from black and white to color in an instant. And that's exactly how I felt. You know, I found the fundamental answer to being alive. And, of course, once I found that answer, then living in black and white became even more excruciating. And I was, I don't know, 13 or 14 years old. I was trailing around with some guys that, you know, I didn't really feel like I was part of the group, but I hung around anyway. And somebody had a bottle, and we passed it around, and the magic happened. And my story differs a little bit from a lot of stories I've heard from the podium. And, you know, the first time I drank, I got drunk. I didn't get sick. You know, I didn't wake up the next morning with it, you know, with feeling like death warmed over. You know, I can probably count all the times I've ever been physically sick on my fingers. And I didn't get hungover very often. You know, I'm one of the people Silkworth talks about from the very beginning because, you know, a drink is poison. Normal people's reaction to alcohol after three or four drinks is nausea. Their body's like, throw that stuff up and get it out of here. Mine has always been, put more in. So I know I'm like not like normal people. You know, my body craved alcohol from the first time I put it in. And I couldn't get drunk every single day. Not when I was 13 or 14 years old, but I started thinking about it every day. I was thinking about it all the time. I was either going towards a drink or I was taking a drink. And because of where I lived, it wasn't all that difficult. Like I said, both of my parents are alcoholics. My parents split up when I was about 6. My mother remarried when I was, I don't know, 10 or 11. She married another alcoholic. So drinking at my house wasn't all that difficult because there was always alcohol around and nobody really noticed. And I'm 52 years old. All this is happening in the early 70s. And you know, the drink in all of its non-conference approved forms was very popular where I was going to school. And, I loved everything. Now, when I was in junior high school and high school, they used to try to teach us about this stuff in health class. I guess they were trying to scare us. They'd say things like, well, if you smoke this stuff, it'll make you laugh and make you silly, but it makes you crazy until you smoke it again. And you take this and you're more wide awake than you ever been. And you feel like Superman, or this makes you sleepy, or this makes you feel like all your problems are gone, but it's very addictive. And if you put this piece of paper under your tongue, you'll see things that aren't there. And I don't know. Maybe they were trying to scare us, but I was like, is there a catalog? where do I sign up? And mostly I loved everything. I could never really see the point of spending perfectly good money to be any more wide awake and aware than I already was, but everything else was fine. And, when I first came around, I used to identify myself as an alcoholic and a drug addict, mostly because I knew it got on the old timers' nerves, and I wanted to be unique, you know. But the truth is, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't want to get on anybody's nerves anymore. I don't believe it matters what poison drove you through those doors, because we all suffer from a soul sickness, and there's one 12-step answer to that. And so, for the sake of not bothering anybody, I call everything a drink, because I am, without a doubt, an alcoholic. So by the time I'm into high school and all my peers are making up their minds about what they want to be when they grow up, I already knew I wasn't going to go to college. I knew I wasn't going to go to trade school. I wanted to be an alcoholic when I grew up. That, and I wanted to be a big time pot dealer. You know, I wanted to have a big house and an exotic sports car and lots of beautiful women. I never made it, but I tried. I tried really, really hard, and I hung out with the people who drank just like I did, and got into all those behaviors. And at first, a lot of them bothered me. It bothered me what we did to each other and to other people. But I didn't open my mouth because for the first time in my life, I felt like I fit in someplace. And because of those behaviors, when I was 18, I went to jail for the first time for a year. It wasn't nearly as scary as I thought it was going to be. And when I came home, I now had another delusion. I thought I was tough on top of thinking I was smart. You know, I suffer from a lot of delusions even now. I hear the word denial a lot. I think alcoholics like me don't suffer from denial. I think that's something Al-Anons have. I don't mean to offend anybody, believe me. But it's like, you know, the Al-Anons, they see us sitting on the couch drunk every day when we're supposed to be at work or out doing something productive. And they tell themselves it's going to be okay, even though deep down inside they know it's not true. People like me, we live insane, tragic lives. We tell ourselves it's going to be okay, and we believe it. So, yeah, I suffer from a lot of delusions. And you know, I came home from jail, and I was born and raised in Philadelphia, but at this time I was living down south in another state, and I got right back into doing what I always did, and almost immediately, within a few months, the authorities wanted to send me back for another year, and I decided I didn't want to go, so I fled the jurisdiction and came home, and I ended up on my mother's doorstep. I hadn't seen or talked to her now in 2 or 3 years, and the only reason this is significant is because The night I showed up on my mom's doorstep, she had about 2.5 weeks sober. You know, you remember what it's like to be 2.5 weeks sober, right? It's like I was the last thing my mom needed to see when she opened her door that night. It's like, surprise! Here I am. I'm sick. I'm in trouble. I'm on the run. But she took me in, and because she was newly sober, her AA friends and her sponsor and people were hanging around, and they took me to meetings. They recognized me right away. And, I said terrible things to the old timers. You know, I'm not one of you. I'm not going to destroy my life the way you people have. I was already well on my way at that point. But I'm going to be the exception. I'm going to be the first alcoholic in history who's not going to let all these terrible things happen to them and a few other things that weren't very nice. And they'd smile and say, keep coming back. You know, and I loved the meeting. For the first meeting I went to, I loved it for about 5 minutes. Everybody was talking about getting loaded. I thought, this is great. Then they started talking about God, and I thought, no, it's not. And I didn't go back. I continued to drink, and my mom continued to stay sober. And I got three younger sisters, two of whom are alcoholics, both of whom have much longer sobriety in AA than I do. But my mom continued to stay sober. My next youngest sister got sober and went right into the treatment business. God bless her. But I started to get a lot of pressure from my family to do something about my drinking. You know, I always had the rationalization, you know, I'm not hurting anybody. You know, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do, because the fact is, I'm an alcoholic. Somewhere along the line, I got a work ethic. And I'm because I'm an alcoholic, I get into routines. And my routine was I got up and went to work every single day. I went to work loaded every day. I sold pot to all my coworkers, so not only was I loaded all day, but they all were too. I stole everything that wasn't nailed down, but I went to work, and so I would use that as a rationalization. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm fine. You know, mind your own business. For a long time, I had a full-time job during the day, a part-time job at night, and I never had $2 to rub together. I never had a car. I never had a license. I never had car fare to get to and from work. I mean, it was ridiculous. Every penny I ever made, I drank up. But eventually, you know, after years of that, I became unemployable. You know, I suffered from a progressive disease, and, you know, my family kept telling me that's what it was, and I didn't really understand. And by the time I was in my mid-30s, I was living in Kensington in an abandoned house, or in a number of abandoned houses, because the other denizens of the mad realm that lived there, too, didn't want me around. Because I had a hard time keeping my hands off stuff that didn't belong to me. And when I needed a drink, nothing ever got in my way. You know, if I couldn't take it from my family, I took it from the people around me. And, you know, like I said, by the time I was in my mid-30s, I didn't work anymore. I didn't bathe. I didn't shave. I didn't cut my hair. You know, I weighed 140 pounds, which is about 65 pounds less than I weigh now. I bounced in and out of jail regularly. I haunted the streets of Center City carrying around a baggie, picking up cigarette butts off the ground and out of butt cans. And when I say I suffer from delusion, that's exactly what I meant, because if you had caught me on one of those days when I'd just come from getting my 102.50 or whatever it was you got every two weeks, or my food stamps, or I'd just stolen something and gotten a few dollars in my pocket, if I had enough money to drink that day, and you'd have caught me and asked me how I was doing, I'd have told you I was doing good. And the thing is, I would have believed it. When anybody sane could have looked at me and said, whoever's running this guy's life is trying to kill him, and it's going to happen soon. And that's what happens. That's what happens when I take a drink. And it was happening. It wasn't just for a few days or a few weeks. It was for years, day after day after day. The same routine. Wake up sick. Go get a drink. Over and over and over. Don't go to work. Don't do anything else. Just completely waste the only life that I have. Over and over and over again. And that's what happened. That's what it's like. And what happened was God stepped in. And if you've been to more than one meeting in your life, you've heard somebody say God works through people, right? That's one of the recurring themes of my story. God works through people. And everything that I think is wrong. But God works through people, and it amazes me how often God came to me dressed as a policeman. You know, or a parole officer or a judge or, you know. And that's what happened. I was on probation for some brilliant idea that I'd had. You know, my first couple of years sober, every morning I hit my knees, and part of my morning prayers were, God, please keep me from having any good ideas today. But I was on probation for some brilliant idea that I'd had, and I got a new probation officer that wanted to see me more than once a year. And the first time I saw him, I gave him a hot urine, and the second time I saw him, he said, usually we let you guys get away with three of these. He said, but you're not going to live long enough to give me three of these. And the thing is, I had no idea what he was talking about. But he locked me up, and I went to see my judge, and she wasn't any happier to see me than he was. Sentenced me to 11 and a half to 23 years, I mean months, excuse me, to be followed by 9 months inpatient in a rehab. I thought that was a little extreme. I mean, 11 and a half months in jail is not a problem. 9 months in a rehab? You got to be kidding. But the thing is, it was a good place. At the time, it was all men, which was important. It was everybody that worked there. It was staffed by graduates of the program. And I started meeting people that were just like me. They had the same story that I did, except they had clean clothes and jobs, and they ate regularly, and they had real lives. And God started putting one person after another in my life. And after 9 months in that program, I did rather well. So they hired me to work there for another couple of years. And if anybody here's been in rehab, you understand, you make friends in a situation like that. When you go through that with other people, you make close friends, especially after 9 months. And the place had a transitional living facility right on the grounds, like a recovery house right on the grounds. And I moved into that with some of the people that I'd gone through the place with, and we did what newly recovering people do. We started making lots of meetings. We went and got jobs. Now we had money in our pockets. We bought beat up old cars. We spent money like it was going out of style. I had friends that had a different pair of sneakers for every day of the week. You know, I bought enough CDs to fill up 20 milk crates. I mean, we were having a ball. We were hanging out in diners. We were going to coffee shops. We went to lots of meetings. We met lots of people. You know, I mean, I love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I absolutely do, because for the first time in my life, I felt like it was some place that I belonged. Whenever I showed up, people were happy to see me, and that was never the case. But, you know, we heard a lot of things at meetings. You know, we heard a lot of people saying, get the book, get into the steps, get a sponsor, write a fearless moral inventory, make amends, start helping people. And we heard a lot of other people saying, just take it easy. Just don't drink. Come back tomorrow. Do these five things every day and you're guaranteed a day's sobriety. A grateful heart will never drink. And, I used to say that that's all I ever heard, but that wasn't true. I've never been to a meeting in my life where somebody wasn't talking about 12 steps, dependence on God, and service to others. But I was looking for an easier, softer way, so I listened to the other guys for a while. And, I belonged to this men's group. I called it my home group. I loved it there, you know. Hour and a half, one day a week, we'd sit around and say terrible things about the women in our lives, you know. How much we hated our bosses and our jobs. And, you know, some guy cut me off on 95, so I chased him 5 miles out of my way, and he's lucky I didn't catch him. Or somebody would raise their hand and say, I'm cheating on my wife or my girlfriend or both. You know, or I'm stealing from where I work and I'm really going through it. And somebody else would say, did you drink today? Well, no. Well, then you're a winner. And I thought, well, then I'm a winner. You know, it's like, you know, I want to be just like these guys. And, you know, it's a shame because I already was, you know. And the grateful heart thing. I mean, I had the five rewards of sobriety. I had the job, the house, the car, the girl, and the motorcycle. How am I ever going to drink with all this stuff? And I was serious. My friends of mine, close friends of mine who were doing the work were telling me, you're heading for a disaster. And I never saw it because I had everything that I'd never had. And I was, on most days, I was happy. I loved being part of AA. I loved being sober. But I didn't have much spiritual fitness, and I somehow made it through 5 years. About a week after I got my 5-year coin, I had to have some minor surgery. And I took a pain pill that I knew, you know, an hour before I took it, I knew I couldn't take it, but I somehow talked myself into the idea that it was going to be all right, and it wasn't. And for the next 2.5 years, nothing funny happened. You know, for the next 2.5 years, every day was a nightmare. You know, and it's like, if you've been to more than one meeting, you've heard somebody say AA is going to ruin your drinking. You've heard somebody say that a belly full of alcohol and a head full of AA don't mix. And I had no idea, you know, I sort of understood what they were talking about, but not really. Not until I picked up that first drink. Then I immediately understood what they meant. You know, I drank my whole life for a sense of ease and comfort. I drank my whole life for a sense of, for some relief. I drank my whole life for a sense of being a part of, and that was gone. I mean, there just wasn't any more ease and comfort. It didn't matter how much I drank. I still felt terrible all the time. I had this voice in my head that never shut up. It just kept saying over and over, what are you doing? You can't do this. You can't, you're sober. You can't drink. What the, you know, and it just never stopped. It didn't matter how much I drank. Unless I was unconscious, I felt horrible. And, I didn't lose everything. You know, I had to sell the motorcycle. It was either that or live under it. But but on my last day sober, I still had a job. I still had a house. I still had a car. I had a nicer car than I do now. I wasn't picking cigarette butts up off the ground. I was still buying brand name cigarettes. I wasn't even down to generics yet. But all this stuff I had was mocking me. I'd go into my house and look at my TV and it's connected to 200 digital cable channels and I'd think, I don't belong here. I belong in Kensington in some abandominium. And everywhere I looked, the better the outside looked, the worse I felt inside. It was horrible. And I mean, if you're here and you've had time sober and drank, you know what I mean. And if you haven't, if you're a first timer, God bless you. But it's like, what everybody else is telling you is 100% true. It's like, if you pick up a drink after some time of sobriety, it's going to suck. It just is. It's never, ever going to be good. And I just couldn't stop. You know, I lived on the streets like an animal for years. But I didn't hit bottom. I hit bottom in a house, in my own house, surrounded by all my stuff. Because I just couldn't stand the way I felt for one more second. And I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. I thought about killing myself all the time. Before I got sober the first time, I never thought about killing myself. And maybe an abstract passing thought every now and then when I think, man, if I was dead, I wouldn't feel this bad. But the second time around, man, it was horrible. And, you know, because I'd been sober 5 years before I picked up, I was in a routine of hitting my knees, rolling out of bed onto my knees every morning. And I have since the first day I got sober. And I still was. I'd roll out of my bed and say, God, please, I can't go on like this. You have to help me. And then I'd get up and go drink. And I guess one morning God said, okay, fine. And a few hours later, he came to my house and pounded on my door. And I said, who is it? Even though I knew who it was, because nobody else pounds like that. And some voice said, Rob, let's not make this difficult. And so I opened the door and some guy, he must have been 6'9" or 7 foot, because I had to look up at him, ran in the door and he's dressed in black and he's wearing a flak jacket and he's got a big weapon and he put a pair of handcuffs on me in the time it took me to blink my eye. I mean, it's like he was really good at his job. He was God, you know, what the hell? Yeah. But, a white male, straight to jail, do not pass go, nothing. And, excuse me. And I'm, you know, and I'm thinking, as they're taking the handcuffs off me, I'm thinking a couple of things simultaneously. One is, oh man, I am not ready for this. Because all my life, at this point, I've wasted about 7 years of my life in jail. And all the times that I'd ever gotten locked up, You hear people in jail say, oh, I didn't get arrested, I got rescued. And that was always the case for me. You know, they'd bring me into jail on death's doorstep. You know, I'd get over being sick, I'd clean up, I'd eat, I'd get in some kind of shape, and then I'd go home. But this time, I was used to eating real food every day. You know, I was used to sleeping on a pillow top mattress. I was used to watching TV that I could hear. I was used to peace and quiet. And there ain't nothing, none of that going on State Road. And, you know, I wasn't ready. And the place is full of people who can look at you and in a split second, they can tell immediately, he ain't ready to be here. So it was kind of rough for a couple of weeks until I got it back into the routine. But at the same time, I'm thinking, thank God. Thank God, because this is the only thing that ever stops me. And I knew I was drunk when I was arrested. And I just knew that that was my last drink. That's the last time I'm going to feel like this. And I wasn't asking God. I wasn't saying, oh, please let this be the last time. I just knew. And, you know, everything just started to fall into place. You know, maybe not to the way, maybe not to my plan, but everything started falling into place. I went to see my judge a few weeks later. She sentenced me to immediate parole to a drug program. It took them 10 months to find me a bed. So I sat in jail for 10 months. They put me immediately into the in-house drug program in jail. The woman who ran it was actually a woman that I'd met in the room. So she gave me a big book right away and some Hazelden workbooks. And even though they're not my favorite thing in the world, they kept me busy. 10 months later, I was released into a rehab, and I don't know. I don't remember a whole lot about my time there because it was everybody there had come from where I came from. Very few of the people were about anything, but I could start having visitors, and my sober friends started coming immediately to see me. And when I was finished 3 months there, they said you can't go home. You got to go to a recovery house for 3 months. The first day I went to the recovery house, there was a guy there. He said, you want to go out to a meeting? I said, yeah, I've been locked up, you know, at this point, 13 months. I'll go anywhere. So we go downtown, and we're standing at a corner in Center City, Philadelphia, about 10 blocks away from the place, and standing out in front of a church, and there's people there smoking and drinking coffee, and it's not AA. It's another fellowship, but it didn't matter. It was a meeting, and I wanted to go, and this girl that I'd known a few years before that I'd met in rehab a few years before that, walks up the sidewalk, sees me there, runs over, gives me a hug. She's like, oh, it's so good to see you. Where you been? We start talking. We go into the meeting. About 20 minutes into the meeting, she leans over and says to me, these people here are really rude. She said, but there's a great AA meeting in the community center in the building right behind this church. She said, tomorrow at 8, and that's where I'll be. And she got up and left. And I thought, well, that's where I'll be too, for sure, you know. I mean, for the first time in my life, God comes dressed as a pretty girl. And so I go there the next night. She shows up a couple of times, then she's in the wind, and I really haven't seen her since. But there was something about this meeting. You know, first thing, it was a big book meeting, and you know, my first 5 years in AA, man, I'd come into a meeting before it started. If I saw books on the chairs or the tables, I'd leave. You know, because I was all about fellowship, but I wasn't really about the work. But I stayed at this meeting, and these people, everybody stuck out their hand. And it's a pretty big meeting. And it was just something about these people. I had no idea what they were talking about, but they all looked great. And what they were saying was attracting me. And I know that was God. It had nothing to do with me. But I stayed. And a few days later, my closest friend came to the halfway house on a Friday night and picked me up and took me to a meeting out in Bucks County. And, you know, on the way out there, he's like, what are you going to do different this time? And I opened my mouth to say, I know what I got to do. And instead I said, I have no idea. You tell me. He said, perfect. We get to this meeting, and there's this guy there that I'd known before I went out. He said, you remember that guy? I said, yeah. Just go over there and ask him to be your sponsor. And I turned to say, I'll do it after the meeting, or I'll do it tomorrow, or I'll do it next week, or, you know, I'm in a recovery house right now. I don't need to do this right now. And there was nothing I could say. He wasn't listening to none of it. And so I walked over. I walked over and I said, will you be my sponsor? No, I didn't. I walked over and said, if you're not real busy, do you think maybe you could help me with these steps if you have time? You know, because I didn't want to ask another man to help me. I'd just as soon ask another man to slow dance. But the thing is, he knew what I wanted. And now when guys come to me and ask me like that, I know what they want. You don't have to call me. I don't go on titles. You don't have to call me your sponsor. You want me to sit down and help you with the steps? Please, it's my pleasure and it's my privilege. But, you know, he said, I want you to get involved in some kind of book meeting. I said, you know, that's funny. I said, because I recently am. He said, make it your home group and get involved. And I did, and I've been there twice a week at least ever since. And then we got to work, and, you know, after all this time, I really still didn't understand what powerless meant, or conceding to my innermost self. He said, yeah, you got the part about you're allergic and you can't take one with, you know, you can't take one drink without setting off a chain that ends up with you in a cell every time. He said, but why is it you keep picking up that first one? And, you know, we looked at it, and the doctor's opinion, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I need a couple drinks to go to work. I need a couple drinks to be in any kind of social situation. I need a couple of drinks to be around my family. I could live with that, but every time I take that couple of drinks, I set off that craving, and I don't go to work. I drink. I don't go out and hang out with people. I drink. You know, I don't go around my family because they're all sober. They're the last people I want to be around when I'm drinking. Unless I need something, of course. And the problem is, no matter how hard I try, I can't not take the first one. And my life is just a total disaster. And it's going to get worse until I die, and there's nothing I can do about that. And once I finally realize that, once I concede that to my innermost self, man, there better be a power greater than myself or I'm done. But I have a problem with that, because when I come in, I don't really believe in God. I do. But I believe enough to know that it's not going to work for me. Because when I come in, I know stuff, believe me. I know a lot of stuff. Every bit of it is wrong. You know, but I know stuff. And thankfully, I'm surrounded by people that are much more intelligent than I am. You know, we read Bill's story, and he has the same problems that I do. Yeah, okay, maybe there's something there, but, you know, with ministers in the world's religions, I part company and all that. God's responsible, you know, the Bible's responsible for more bloodshed and pain, all that nonsense that I used to spout, thinking I'd made it up. You know, and here's a guy 75 years before me who thought the same way. But there's a line about, I had no doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all, and I got to start with that, you know. I was told it didn't matter. I don't have to put a face on it. I don't have to put a name on it. I don't have to go to an ornate building to worship it every week. I just have to know that there's something there, and I can start with that. And then we read agnostics, and I think the part about where I'm going to find God is the most important thing I've ever heard, because all my life, deep down inside, you know, it's like this is something I heard Joe and Charlie explain, and it just made perfect sense. You know, deep within me, I've always had that voice that knew the difference between right and wrong, that knew that it was always directing me in a direction where I wasn't going to hurt myself, or I especially wasn't going to hurt another human being. It never this power, this voice within me has never tried to hurt me. It's always loved me. I paid very little attention to it most of my life, but it's always been there. And if that power is my soul or my conscience, doesn't matter what I call it. If that's there and that's the part of God that is me, then I don't have to fear it anymore. And because I don't fear it, I can easily make a decision to turn my will and my life over to its care. And once I really get it, once I really begin to understand it, then it hits me. If I'm like that, if part of me is God, then part of every other human being is God. And that we're all connected, and we're all part of a greater whole. And every time that I resent or hurt another human being, I'm resenting or hurting myself and hurting God. No wonder I'm separated from everything and everybody and from God. No wonder the character defects that separate me from God are the exact same one that separate me from my fellows. They're the same thing. And so I have to figure out what keeps me separated from God and from my fellows. My resentments, my fears, and my sex conduct and harm I've done to others. I always thought a fourth step was a list of all the bad stuff I'd done. You know, for years that's what I thought. My sponsor said, no, stupid, just read the book. He said, can you make a list of everybody you're mad at? I said, yeah, I think I can manage that. He said, can you make a list of everything you're afraid of? Well, it's going to be a short list. It turned out to be a very long list, in fact. He said, make a list of everyone you've had sex with. And when we go over the list, you know, I finally realized that everything is my fault. That I'm selfish, I'm self-centered, I'm dishonest, and I've spent my entire life thinking that I was God and that there was no power greater than me. And so now I have a list of character defects that I got to be willing to get rid of. And on the surface, I'm like, of course I'm willing to have God remove all these. Absolutely. Look what they're doing to my life. They're driving me to drink. But the truth is I'm not. I want to be 99.9% anger-free. But I still want to reserve the right to get mad at somebody who gets over on me. You know? I mean, it's like, it doesn't make sense for me to want to hold on to any of that anger. I drive new guys to meetings. I want them to want what I have. But you see me behind the wheel of a car, you're going to be like, what is the matter with this person? But I don't want to be 100% anger free. You know, I still want to take pride in my own accomplishments. Like I've ever accomplished anything good. Everything good in my life is God. Every disaster in my life is mine. And I don't want to take pride in that, but I'm still not willing to let it go. I don't want to be 100% lust free. You know, I mean, we've already established that God speaks through people, but, you know, I'd sit at a meeting for an hour and a half and not hear a word because I'm contemplating other things. You know, but I'm still not willing to let this stuff go. So I have to pray for the willingness. Then I have to humbly ask God to remove these things. And my sponsor said, do you have any idea what that means? I said, not really. He said, you want God to take away your anger because, you know, you've been gray since your early 20s. He said, you want God to take away all these things because of what they're doing to you. He said, forget. It's not about you. He said, when you're willing to have God remove these things because of what of how useless it makes you to God and to other people, that's humbly asking. And it's one of the great paradoxes of this program is, you know, when I'm suffering from these defects of character, I'm useless to everybody else. But because I suffered from these character defects, I'm going to be very useful to somebody down the line. But, you know, and so this is a daily thing that I work on. And I'm nowhere near perfect at it. I saw one of my all-time AA heroes speak a couple of months ago. This guy's been sober decades. You know, and he said, my head is like a twin cinema. He said, one side is there's constantly a violent action-adventure playing, and on the other side, it's a porno. And I thought, thank God, somebody else feels like that. I thought I was all by myself. And so I'm not perfect. Now I've got to make a list of everybody I've harmed, because if we're all connected, we're all part of this greater God, then I need to clean up my past. And everybody I've ever come in contact with has suffered to some extent from my dishonesty and my self-centeredness. So I've got a long list. I pray for the willingness, and God makes that possible. And as soon as He grants me the willingness, He puts that person right in front of me. It happens every time. There are some people I had to pray a little harder for, but I eventually got it. I start making these amends. You know, I fear people and economic insecurity. I'm afraid to do this, but because I've been painstaking about this process, I'm starting to have a spiritual awakening. The promises, the ninth step promises, I was told are a perfect description of a spiritual awakening, and this is starting to happen to me. And because of that, I now have God on my side, and I find the courage to make these amends. And of course, you know, this is another thing I think, another thing that I know, because I know lots of stuff, and I know I'm going to do my family first, because they're going to be the easy ones. After a few years, I come to realize that I'd much rather face somebody I've stolen some money from than sit there and listen to my mother tell me what I put her through for the last 20-something years. You know, I thought that was going to be easy. That turned out to be some of the hardest stuff I've ever done. You know, to listen to my mother and my little sisters. But, you know, the harder ones are always have the most benefits. And like I said, I'm starting to have a spiritual awakening, and I got to start growing in this. So I got to constantly watch for my motives. I got to try to live in today, live in the now. And I didn't really understood what that meant at first. Step 10 says I continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And, you know, selfishness, God, that's all I ever think about. You know, dishonesty is mostly within myself. I got to stop lying to myself. Resentment and fear. You know, I'm not in the now. If I resent something, it's because I'm in the past. And if I fear something, it's because I'm in the future. And the problem is, it says in how it works that there's one who has all power. May you find him now. And now is a place I very rarely visit. But the problem is, if God is now, because God's not 5 minutes ago, God's not yesterday, God's not tomorrow, God is now. The more time I spend away from now, the more time I spend away from the only thing that's keeping me from throwing my life over a cliff. And so I have to start practicing this all the time. And I have to start praying and meditating for God's will. And I heard a guy a couple of months ago talking about this, and I loved it. He said, we have all these prayers with thy will be done and God's will be done. He says, God's will's being done. He said, you're like an ant on a log rushing down the river and you think you're steering it. He said, you know, the only way you're going to start feeling better is to realize that it's completely out of your hands and everything that happens is exactly the way it's supposed to. And it's true. What was once baffling and perplexing has become intuitive. You know, I know the difference between right and wrong. If I have to think about something for more than a second or two, it's because it's something that I know is wrong and I'm trying to rationalize it. Doesn't mean that I don't do it, but I know. And I gotta carry this message to others. And man, I love that. I love doing this. I love sitting down across from another guy with that book. I love it. I love sitting there reading something with somebody and then something hits me and hits him at the same time. And he says, that's what that means. And I'm like, yeah, like I knew it all along. You know, it says on page 164, God will disclose more to you and to us. And that's exactly what it means. I have so many aha moments now. I either have aha, wow, that's what that means, or aha, I'm really a piece of crap. You know, but it's like, man, I love this. And because of that, I have to practice these principles. I knew an old timer who I learned a ton from who said, I can't hear your message because your example is blinding me or deafening me. And he's right. You know, because it's like my default position is dishonesty. My default position is selfishness and self-centeredness. But the only thing that's keeping me alive is trying to help other people. I have to my hypocrisy has its limits. And the thing is this is the only thing that makes sense. I look back at my whole life. God has been divinely crafting me since day one to do exactly what I'm doing right this second. It's the only thing that makes sense. All the things that have happened to me have led to this point. Or I can look at it as all the things that have had to happen to me have been some kind of strange coincidence, and that doesn't make any sense. I'm supposed to be here doing this. Why else would everything have happened the way it has? And so, because that's the truth, I feel better when I'm doing this than when I'm home, sitting at home watching television. It doesn't keep me from looking at the telephone and hitting ignore when I'm watching something, but I know what makes me feel good. And, man, because of all this, I never had it so good. And life is not a painless thing. This is not a bed of roses. You know, 2.5 weeks ago my mom died. You know, my enabler and then my inspiration, my hero, my best friend, and it sucked. I felt terrible. But the thing is, I didn't take it personally. You know, before I got sober, it would have been all about me. Look how bad I feel. How dare you do this to me? Why didn't you quit smoking when you had a chance? You know, all that nonsense. Not only did I not take it personally, I have no regrets because, you know, I hadn't completely made amends. That would have been a lifetime process, maybe a two-lifetime process. But I was making amends every day. I said everything that I needed to say. And my mom died knowing she didn't have to worry about me anymore. Knowing that she don't have to carry me anymore, that now God's carrying me. And I got to be there for my sisters. For the first time in my life, I got to be a part of my family. I've been sober almost 7 years this time. And I am finally an integral part of my family. And the experience, I don't have any words to describe how good this experience was. Yeah, it was painful. But nothing good in life comes without some kind of price. You know, it's like the economy's still a mess. I still struggle to make a living. You know, I've got such a ridiculous criminal record. I don't work in the real world anymore. You know, nobody's going to look at my resume and hire me. But I'm part of AA. I'm in rooms full of people every day that are just like me. You know, when I come in, I get with somebody who's just like me, who's had his own business for a few years. He hires me. Until I'm able to go into business for myself and hire guys that are just coming in. And it grows and it grows and it grows. And somehow I still manage to pay my bills. You know, I still have a cell phone. I still have digital cable. You know, I'm not doing too bad. You know, it's like, oh God, what is that noise this car is making now? But somehow everything works out. You know, I mean, this is, and I get to be part of AA, man. I love this. I mean, I come here and I know one or two people in this room, but the truth is I've got a whole room full of friends that I haven't met yet. And I can't go into any other social situation like that. You know, I've had a spiritual awakening. I'm comfortable in my own skin. I'm comfortable at work. I'm comfortable at home. I'm comfortable in social situations. But the place I'm most comfortable, the place I like the best, is my home group. Man, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in here, I was an absolute disaster. I was completely useless to myself, to God, or to anybody else. I hated myself. I hated the world. I was awkward. I was uncomfortable. I was completely apart from. You know, you guys welcomed me. You didn't just say welcome. You made me feel welcome. And you made me feel welcome long enough to show me a 12-step process that you used to find a power greater than myself. That has given me a life beyond, totally beyond my wildest dreams. And I want to thank each and every one of you for my life. God bless.